support for OPB comes from our members and from our sponsors, like Mike Rosenberg from Columbia Credit Union. Mike says they trust what they see and hear on OPB, and that aligns with Columbia Credit Union's brand.
It's OPB Politics Now for Friday, February 2nd. The 2024 short legislative session starts next week. Over the course of 35 days, lawmakers hope to pass millions of dollars to help the housing shortage, and they will perhaps make small amounts of illicit drugs illegal again. It promises to be a fast, even frenetic-paced month. And so, in that spirit, Dirk and I are going to make this podcast snappy and give you the lightning round version of what you need to know about how your taxpayer dollars are being spent and the decisions your elected officials are making. Welcome to the podcast. I'm OPB politics reporter Lauren Dake.
And I'm OPB politics reporter Dirk Vanderhart.
Dirk, first up, the latest news. The Oregon Supreme Court ruled that the Senate Republicans who staged the longest walkout in the state's history last session are not eligible to seek re-election. This is pretty big news.
It is, yes. This is news that people in the Capitol were eagerly waiting for, and that's partly because there seemed to be a genuine question about which way it would go. And at risk of sort of derailing your snappy idea here, Lauren, I do think we should recap this a little bit. So Republicans had challenged Measure 113, this ballot measure from 2022 that basically said that lawmakers who walk out can't seek re-election. Remember, 10 Senate Republicans ran afoul of that law last year when they walked, but they also made a very interesting argument in court, which was that due to sloppy wording of the measure, they could actually serve an entire extra term before being blocked from seeking re-election, before those penalties kicked in. And I have to say, people will disagree with this, but I think anyone who reads the actual language of the state constitution as the measure changed it would likely come to that conclusion. I mean, the plain language of the sentences involved just do seem to indicate that Republicans had a point, but the court found otherwise. It accepted, I think, a more maybe tortured interpretation, maybe more novel interpretation of the language that voters approved, and they did so for one central reason, which is that there is really no question that voters intended for the consequences to be immediate when they voted this measure into law. Even if the language they approved was pretty bad, it's quite clear in my mind that the intent was that these penalties kick in immediately. So that's the version that the court accepted. As a result, all 10 lawmakers who walked out last year will be ineligible to seek re-election either this year or when they come up again in 2026.
Republicans were clearly not happy with this decision, and after it became public, they suggested that the Oregon Supreme Court landed on that tortured decision, as you said, because they were exhibiting partisan bias.
Yeah, and I think ahead of this decision, you know, actually there was a lot of optimism from Republicans. They felt like they had made a really good case. They felt there was case law backing them. They paid a lot of money for a good attorney, and they were really hopeful they'd found this loophole that showed Democrats and their allies had been sloppy in pushing the measure. But obviously that didn't happen. Actually, the Supreme Court said in its opinion that it was following its sort of precedent in interpreting this kind of thing. So in response, you're right, Republicans sort of very bluntly accused the justices of making a political decision that was based on sloppy law. And they did that by pointing out that all 7 Supreme Court justices were initially appointed by Democratic governors, either former Governor Kate Brown or in one instance, Tina Kotek. Senate Republican leader Tim Knope was one of those making that point. Here's what he said yesterday.
I don't think anybody's going to argue with the fact that there are no Republicans on that court, because there aren't. And there are no conservatives either. And so I'm not really surprised by the decision.
That is the sound of a very resigned, I think, Tim Knope, whose long legislative career will be ending in January because of this ruling. I think we should point out, though, that none of these lawmakers are actually banned from seeking re-election forever. They just have to sit out one term under the measure, and it is entirely possible some of these folks re-emerge down the road. Knope himself certainly wasn't making any guarantees about his next moves.
So how do you anticipate this decision changing the political dynamic for this upcoming short session?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big question, right? Like Republican senators and particularly Canope have not been shy about threatening to walk out once again if they don't like what Democrats are up to. And Canope told reporters this week that if the court case was unsuccessful, as it was, Republicans would feel like they have nothing to lose. Now, I kind of don't understand that logic, I'll be honest, because even if the Republicans had won yesterday, they would still be barred from seeking re-election down the road. There would be no further consequences they could suffer for walking out. So I don't know that they had anything to lose regardless. But in any case, I think right now it really doesn't feel much like we've got the same kind of session in the works that Republicans are bent on walking after this. You know, remember last year, from the very outset of session, Canope was making plain that he had sort of beef with Senate President Rob Wagner. Republicans were playing hardball right from the beginning because they said they weren't being given input in the process. This year just feels different. Earlier this week, Canope suggested all the indications he's getting is that his party will be taken seriously. And I think if that holds, perhaps this is a far less dramatic session. I am certainly crossing my fingers for that. But there's, I think, another question here, Lauren, which is what this ruling means for future legislative sessions, whether or not this is going to curb walkouts in the long term. And I don't know, how are you feeling about that?
Ah, saving the hard questions for me, huh, Dirk? it's unanswerable, really. I mean, there's just so many factors. Who will be the future lawmakers? Will they think that the nuclear option is worth it? Here is what I can say. Lawmakers generally want to work together. They generally want to stay in office if they've gone to the trouble to get elected. And now we know that the consequences for walking out are going to be greater. I will speculate and say I'm not convinced this is going to end all future legislative walkouts in this era of great political divide, but it's going to make those prolonged walkouts less appealing. And I also want to point out something that we have pointed out on this podcast many times. This has been a tool used by the minority party, including Democrats when they were in the minority, long before Republicans really popularized it in the last couple of years. I am going to keep my answer snappy in the spirit of this podcast and switch to asking you another question. So let's switch chambers and talk about the state house. Over there, the two leaders, Speaker Dan Rayfield and House Republican Leader Jeff Helfrich, have started off the session on a very optimistic note. They said that they do not foresee any major disagreements that might upend the things in that chamber.
That's right. Yeah. Remember, the House has sort of been a model of courtesy in many ways lately. It was last year compared to the Senate, and it seems set to be the same this year. Both Rayfield and Helfrich say they are taking a no surprises approach, which suggests, you know, they're not going to spring bills or maneuvers on one another. They truly do seem to agree on at least the topics that lawmakers need to make a priority this year.
Okay, let's talk about some of those topics. Let's start with Measure 110. We've talked a lot about Measure 110 on the podcast. How fast can you hit us with where we are currently at?
Okay, I'm going to try on this one. We are pretty much at where we were the last time we talked. You know, Democrats have unveiled a proposal to make possession of small amounts of drugs a misdemeanor. That would end the state's experiment with decriminalization. That will be the central proposal that gets debated this session. But one new thing that we learned this week, I think that is notable, is that Governor Tina Kotek is willing to sign a bill recriminalizing drugs, or at least is strongly suggesting that she's willing to. The governor said in comments to reporters that, you know, the threat of criminal penalties is one tool she's open to as she works to address the fentanyl crisis that is having all sorts of terrible impacts. But she also emphasized that lawmakers will need to send her a blueprint for expanding services and getting drug users connected to those services alongside any proposal to ratchet up criminal penalties. Here's what she said.
I know there's a lot of focus on the recriminalization, but I would hope everybody looks at this as a comprehensive package. It is about what you do on the front end as it relates, for example, to the misdemeanor, but it's also about connecting people with services, making sure we're planning better, making sure we're making investments.
And I would say I think this is a notable shift for Kotek. Remember, as a gubernatorial candidate in 2022, she was very much against reintroducing criminal penalties for drug possession. She wanted to wait until the state had fully implemented Measure 110, you know, built out services and all that before assessing the law. And even as recently as December, she was noncommittal about supporting criminal penalties. So now she appears to be on board. She has moved, along with a lot of other elected Democrats, in that direction as the fentanyl crisis has become more clearly such a crisis.
Who else do we have backing this proposal, and who's lined up against it so far?
I mean, I think the question of who backs this proposal is really interesting because I frankly have no idea. What we do know is who is against it, right? Republicans, law enforcement groups, many cities want stiffer possible consequences for possession than Democrats are currently putting forward. Decriminalization advocates say ending decriminalization would be a tragic misstep. They are really pushing hard against this as fairly draconian and just stupid. But basically, everyone says at the end of the day, all they want is for people to get treatment. It just seems everyone sort of has a different idea about the best way to convince drug users to accept it. So that's where we're at. Okay, Lauren, let's talk about the other big topic of the session, which is housing. Governor Kotek wants a lot of money to put toward that in the next 35 days. But maybe the most contentious piece of her proposal is surrounding land use. So walk us through it.
You're right. A lot of money. The governor is requesting $500 million in state funds, which that's a big budget ask for a short 35-day session. But she is saying she believes it's crucial to increasing the state's housing stock and reaching those very aggressive housing goals that she's laid out clearly more than a year ago now. The governor wants to set up a new state agency, the Housing Accountability and Production Office, that she said she sees as a way to help developers and local governments navigate the bureaucratic hurdles that might slow down development. And then, yes, part of the bill that will likely and has already generated pushback is that the bill would allow cities outside of the Portland metro region a chance to unilaterally pull a certain amount of land, and the amount of land depends on the population of the city, into the urban growth boundary to develop that land. And bringing new land into the UGB is often really lengthy, sometimes litigious, and that process entails a lot of public input. So she's giving these jurisdictions an opportunity to essentially bypass all of that, which a lot of conservation groups do not love. Dirk, what else are you watching this session?
I mean, I'm still at the stage, right, where I don't know exactly what I should be looking for. The bills posted earlier this week, I will be frank, I have not had the opportunity to go through all of them. But there are a couple things I'm definitely going to be looking out for. One big one is next Wednesday, when lawmakers will be receiving their latest quarterly revenue forecast that is really going to sketch the trajectory of how much money they're able to spend this session, right? I mean, we've heard something like $1.2 billion they could have on tap to spend this year. That could change dramatically depending on what the state's economist tells them on Wednesday. So it's going to be a very important presentation, I think. There are just also a lot of other bills in the mix, right? There are at least two competing proposals for raising taxes, asking voters to raise taxes for wildfire prevention. I would be pretty surprised if those get to be serious discussions given how weighty that is, but maybe. You just never know what's going to move forward in a short session. So, you know, there's a lot, and we don't know what we don't know at this point. How about you, Lauren?
Okay, one thing I think is really interesting is the governor wants to create a new fiscal accountability and transparency dashboard through the state's Department of Education. And the idea there is to just make this whole process of school budgeting more transparent. And that really comes out of the month-long school strike with Portland Public Schools in November, where it seemed like the district and the unions were not on the same page about what money was even available. So this is an attempt to really make it more transparent for school districts statewide. And I think that is something we will certainly follow at OPB. I'm going to call it. We tried to make that podcast feel fast, similar to the short legislative session. It may have felt long in some parts. I don't know. But either way, thank you so much for listening. This episode of OPB Politics Now is produced by Andrew Thien. Our audio engineer is Nalin Silva, and our music comes from Audio Network. We'll be back next week with more political news from across the Pacific Northwest. Until then, you can find all of OPB's reporting at opb.org.
If you tune into OPB Politics Now because you love learning about what's happening in our region, you'll love listening to The Evergreen. This weekly podcast paints an audio portrait of the Pacific Northwest through the stories of the people who live here. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.